A behind-the-scenes drama involving a Texas senator could have major implications for the U.S. and Iran. What's happening and why it matters today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. Student athletes getting kicked out of one college following complaints of sexual assault, but getting to start over at another school. A new report about a sexual predator pipeline claims the NCAA is looking the other way. Also, a new initiative in Cowtown to preserve those wide open spaces Texas is so famous for before they disappear. All those stories and a whole lot more on the national news show of You Know Where. And it all gets started right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard Time on this 16th day of December 2019. I understand that there are some swans a-swimming and geese a-laying long about now. I'll have to get back to you on that. On a more serious note, we turn our attention on this Monday to a name you'll probably be familiar with, Mike Pompeo. He's the U.S. Secretary of State, or at least that's his title as of now. But a few savvy folks have noticed that he may be looking for a new gig. The Hill, a publication out of D.C., noted this weekend that Pompeo has opened a personal Twitter account, one which sources say he is preserving for future plans. This amid speculation Pompeo may be interested in making a run for a seat in the U.S. Senate, representing his home state of Kansas. Which has what to do with Texas, I hear you asking? Horse trading, that's what. According to the Associated Press, there is a certain Texas senator doing some behind-the-scenes deal-making that could have major implications for Pompeo and perhaps, with far greater consequence, U.S. policy with Iran and the future of the State Department. The AP's Matthew Lee has been reporting this story. Matthew, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you.
Why is it exactly that Ted Cruz has injected himself into, he hasn't actually injected himself into Pompeo's future plans, but in a sense, I guess he has. What's going on?
So here's the deal. Ted Cruz is among several leading Iran hawks on Capitol Hill, along with Tom Cotton and Marco Rubio and Lindsey Graham and others. And he, last week, put a hold on the nomination of Stephen Biegun, who is currently the U.S. envoy for North Korea, to be the Deputy Secretary of State.
Now, why would he do that?
Well, he did it because he wanted the State Department to release a legal opinion that says that the U.S., even though President Trump had withdrawn the U.S. from the Iran nuclear deal, he wanted the State Department to release a legal opinion that says that even though the U.S. has withdrawn, it is still technically a participant in the agreement when it comes to the U.N. Security Council. The U.N. Security Council has the right under the Iran nuclear deal to snap back all of the U.N. sanctions that were lifted in 2015 after the agreement if any one of the participants says to do so. And the State Department did not want to release this opinion because they think that it is an internal deliberative document. And Ted Cruz said, no, you've got to release this or I am going to block Steve Biegun's nomination to be the Deputy Secretary of State. Now, why this is important for a potential Pompeo Senate run is that the current Deputy Secretary of State, John Sullivan, was just confirmed last week to be the new ambassador to Russia. So if there was no Deputy Secretary of State, it would go to the job of acting Secretary of State would go to David Hale, who is the most senior career Foreign Service officer at the State Department, but who also testified in the impeachment hearing into President Trump.
I see.
There was a bit of panic at the State Department last week when Ted Cruz put this hold on Steve Biegun. You know, it's now been lifted because the legal opinion was released. But yeah, it's all a bit of a weird musical chairs.
Very interesting. So does it now look like Steve Biegun is going to be the next Secretary of State if, in fact, Pompeo steps away? Does this clear the way for Stephen Biegun, I guess?
Yes, it does. And so if Secretary Pompeo does, in fact, decide to resign and go back to Kansas to run for the Senate, the new deputy, as soon as he is confirmed, Steve Biegun, which we're expecting sometime this week, would step in as the acting Secretary of State, and potentially he could even be nominated. You know, Biegun is a former Ford Motor Company executive. He's quite well respected by both sides of the aisle, even in these highly partisan political times. And so, you know, this does in fact open a pathway for Secretary Pompeo if he wants to leave to run for Senate and to keep the leadership of the State Department. To keep some continuity in the leadership of the department.
Very interesting to see how Texas is throwing its political weight around, albeit behind the scenes here. Matthew Lee has been covering this story for the AP. Matthew, good to talk with you. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
A 6'4", 250-pound college football player is accused by two women of sexual assault. Out on bond, University of South Florida finds he did indeed violate school policies regarding consent, and he's expelled from campus. But it's not the end of his college football career. Instead, a year later, while still facing potentially decades behind bars, Ladarius Jackson is playing for Tennessee State. His story is far from unique. In fact, a new investigation finds the practice of transferring student-athletes previously disciplined for sexual offenses at schools across the nation, Texas included. It dubs the practice the Predator Pipeline. Kenny Jacoby is an investigative data reporter for USA Today. Kenny, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you so much for having me.
The point that you're making here with this story, it seems, is that there are many ways that college athletes can lose their NCAA credibility or eligibility, but sexual assault is not one of them. Why?
The NCAA has essentially deferred to the institutions themselves to take action against student athletes who commit sexual violence. But while a university can, you know, suspend or expel an athlete it finds responsible, nothing stops that athlete from then transferring elsewhere, where his sanctions essentially disappear. And as for why the NCAA hasn't taken action to prevent that from happening, it's really anyone's guess. A handful of conferences and schools have taken action on their own, but there's no association-wide rules.
You write that there are more than 30 NCAA players who've been transferred to other college athletic programs despite being found responsible for sexual offenses by the previous institutions. Could you give us some examples other than the one that we mentioned there of Ladarius Jackson?
There's one player who is started at University of Oregon. His name is Tristan Wallace. And within Tristan's first 4 months on the Oregon campus, two female students accused him of rape. Oregon found him responsible in both cases and actually expelled him twice, and found his conduct to be so severe that it marked his transcripts with the words "expelled for sexual misconduct." So anybody who was considering accepting him into their school would know of his past conduct. Yet that didn't stop Tristan from transferring to Prairie View A&M University near Houston, Texas, where he's played the last 2 years as a Division I football player.
Ultimately, who is this on? The player, the university, the NCAA?
Well, I would say first and foremost, it's on the universities and the coaches for knowingly bringing these players onto campus. And in some cases, as they will tell you, unknowingly. In many instances, we were the first ones to apparently notify them that somebody on their roster had a sexual assault in his past.
I'm sorry, let me stop there. How is that possible? Aren't transcripts and that sort of thing required to make a transfer?
Typically, transcripts are required, but transcripts don't always note previous conduct offenses. In fact, probably a minority of the time they do. And when coaches are vetting these recruits, typically all they do is talk to a former coach of his and get a character reference. But in many of these cases, these coaches aren't providing all the information and telling them that, hey, this person was found responsible in a Title IX case. There's also a form that schools use called a tracer, which asks questions about past disciplinary actions. Mm-hmm. But the question is also so narrowly worded that it fails to capture a lot of past disciplinary offenses. And so some schools told us that the tracers came back clean, even though the student athlete did have a disciplinary action in his past.
Did any of the schools that you contacted say that they were going to investigate further or in fact drop the players that they had added?
So some said that they were going to investigate further. One of them was the University of North Texas, after we notified them that a football player on its roster had been found responsible for sexual misconduct back at his previous Division I school. But they have not said that the athlete has been removed from the team. In fact, he remains on the roster. And in other such cases as well, we were told we're going to look into this. And then sure enough, a few weeks later, the athlete is back on the field.
Kenny Jacoby is an investigative data reporter for USA Today. We will link to his story at texasstandard.org. Kenny, thanks so much for taking a few minutes out to talk with us on The Standard.
Thank you so much for having me.
Hey, let's find out what Texans are talking about on this Monday. Here's social media editor Wells Dunbar.
Hello, David. We're hearing from our friends and listeners online about the story we just heard, how a new investigation found that student athletes disciplined for sexual offenses regularly transfer to new colleges and keep playing. On the Texas Standard Facebook page, Randy Smith says it's about money for these organizations like the NCAA and the colleges that work with these players. And Janice Hitchcock concurs. She says as long as the man is taking in the money for them, they don't care what he does. Winning trumps ethics in this day and age, she says. Well, that's just one story we're watching this Monday. A couple others. The Judiciary Committee's release of a new 658-page report making the case for impeachment ahead of a likely House vote on Wednesday. And also how the mayoral and city council runoffs this weekend in Houston shook out. I noticed there's some pretty interesting stuff there on the Instagram page of a one Tony Busby. That would be the unsuccessful mayoral challenger down there in H-Town. So we're following that story as well. I'll be back with reactions to both of those stories, plus lots more later in the broadcast.
Interesting that NPR had that story on the poll regarding the impeachment and how numbers just aren't moving after weeks of testimony and all of that. Another story, I suppose you could file this under breaking news, the U.S. Supreme Court letting stand a Ninth Circuit ruling from last year that homeless individuals cannot be prosecuted because their situation is an unavoidable consequence of one's status or being. Going to be a whole lot more discussion of that, I'll bet. Let's hear from you, Texas, at Texas Standard.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Association of Community Colleges, providing pathways for Texans to advance the individual aspirations of students while focusing on accessibility, affordability, and relevance. More at tacc.org. Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas ABLE program, helping eligible Texans with disabilities save and plan for the future to pay for qualified disability expenses with a tax-advantaged ABLE account. Learn more at texasable.org.
Hey, this is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. The U.S. military is known for keeping its house in order, but military families living at Joint Base San Antonio Randolph have complained for quite a while about poor housing conditions and bad maintenance. Now, leadership at the base has announced new measures to rein in a private contractor managing some 300 homes there. Texas Public Radio's Carson Frame was at a town hall where officials got an earful from some of the families affected.
Inside Fleener Auditorium, some 25 families vented their frustration with base leadership and private housing contractor Hunt Military Communities. In late October, eight families sued the contractor for damages and mental anguish. One of the plaintiffs, Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Mark Hyatt, told base leadership that he needed help getting out of his home, which has a cracked foundation, pervasive mold, and sewage issues.
I live in a house that is literally killing me. As a military, we are a family. Please interact, defend us, protect us. This is not the way that I want to lead the Air Force.
A worker found sewage 8 inches deep under Mary Beth Pisano's home at Randolph. An independent mold testing company found that there were 66,000 mold spores per square inch. She fled with her family to a rental home off base.
Currently, all of my belongings are still in that house, and I appreciate everyone and all that you guys have tried to do on our behalf, but I feel like there's a failure, and we are like the poster child for that failure.
Base officials touted a new online work order program called Satisfax. It allows the Air Force to track when residents file maintenance requests with Hunt and when they're completed. The program has a built-in survey where residents can rate the quality of work that was done. Richard Trevino of the 502nd Civil Engineering Group says Satisfax gives the Air Force more oversight over Hunt, which has been accused of neglecting repairs.
They cannot just go out there and close work orders like what was assumed in the past. It now becomes very, very structured.
Base leaders also outlined a plan to follow up with families who rate their experiences less than a 3.5 out of 5. After the town hall, JBSA Commander Laura Lenderman said Hunt has improved its performance as the base has taken steps to monitor it.
I think as we're getting better at this, they're getting better too. It's kind of a partnership. We're learning as we go.
Military housing became privatized in 1996. The military services were authorized to enter into 50-year leases with private developers to own and operate base housing. In recent years, families across the country have complained about conditions, and lawsuits are pending in several states. I'm Carson Frame in San Antonio.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping companies protect their drivers on the road. More at worksafetexas.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. You know, there was a time when people were drawn to Texas by the allure of wide open spaces. The promise of what all that nothingness could be was a magnet. Well, now plenty of people are still attracted to Texas. That part hadn't changed. But at least in some of the bigger cities, space is becoming harder and harder to come by. That's at the heart of a new initiative by the city of Fort Worth that aims to do nothing. The idea is for Cowtown to acquire undeveloped land and keep it that way. Here to tell us more is the person spearheading the effort, Jennifer Dyke. She is the Stormwater Program Manager for the city of Fort Worth. Jennifer, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about what's behind this project to keep undeveloped land undeveloped.
Yes, so we have around 20,000 new people moving to Fort Worth every year. And so now we're the 13th largest city in the United States. And so we want this growth and development, but we want to make sure that it's smart and sustainable. And so one of the ways to do that is to plan for growth and to identify these key open spaces so we can grow and develop around them and save them from development.
So if I understand the plan correctly, the city would actually make the sort of investment in the property that developers might otherwise make. Is that the idea?
Yes, really trying to identify those key special parcels to be good stewards of the environment, to really protect the special places for our community.
You know, I remember the city of San Diego did something like this many decades back, perhaps some listeners may remember Pete Wilson was mayor of San Diego, and they went on to he went on to be governor of California. This sounds very similar to that process. You're talking about doing something long term that would pretty much, it would occupy a lot of space for Fort Worth. Where would those new residents go? Aren't we looking at greater density in some of the places that are already developed?
Oh, definitely. We want the growth to happen around these open spaces. We definitely don't want to become the largest landowner in the city of Fort Worth. We just really want to identify those key parcels that meet multiple public policy objectives and grow around those. We want people to be able to access the natural environment from the built environment.
What's the Stormwater Protection Manager doing spearheading the program like this?
So this is really an exciting effort. It's very collaborative at the city of Fort Worth. So while I'm leading this effort, it's definitely not a stormwater effort. And we've got our Parks and Recreation Department involved, planning and development, economic development, communications, environmental, property management. So a huge group really collaborating to really figure out what those key parcels are and what values we want to accomplish by acquiring them.
I'm thinking this could get expensive. I mean, we've all seen land prices in places around the Metroplex and frankly, in major cities across the Lone Star State. We've seen those prices start to skyrocket. How much is it going to cost to do the sort of stuff that you want to do?
Well, that's something definitely that we want to look for partnerships to help us acquire this land and then possibly even maintain this land. So we know that it's going to be expensive, but it's more affordable to do it now than to go back in the future. Obviously, land is a finite resource, and so it's difficult once it becomes developed to identify those spaces and then try to reconvert them to natural areas. So right now, we're really trying to protect those key special open spaces for our current residents and future generations.
You know, you started to address something that I was wondering about. You have some places that have developed, they've aged, some have aged better than others. I wonder, is there a point at which you might start to look at places that have been previously developed, they've perhaps gotten run down, and maybe the city takes those over and starts over ground level, if you will?
I mean, that's definitely an idea, but really kind of what we're looking at is those areas that are already natural and to protect those areas. So one benefit of keeping areas natural is for help with flood reduction and stormwater conveyance. Also, open spaces can improve nearby property values and attract people to those areas, make people want to come and recreate in those open spaces.
I understand that you are a native of the Metroplex yourself. Is that right, Jennifer?
That is correct.
It sounds like this might be near and dear to your heart personally.
Yes, yes. I'm really excited about this. I actually have an environmental degree and an urban planning degree from Texas A&M University. So I'm really excited to work with our team here at the City of Fort Worth to make this possible.
So stop paving over stuff. The idea is to purchase land in Cowtown and try to keep it wide open spaces, like the Dixie Chicks used to sing about. Jennifer Dyke is the Stormwater Protection Manager for the City of Fort Worth. Jennifer, thanks so much for spending a few minutes with us on the Texas Standard. We certainly do appreciate it.
Thank you.
So 90 minutes from downtown Dallas to Houston, closer than ever to reality. The Dallas Morning News reporting the much ballyhooed high-speed train currently waiting on federal approval. Main holdups are environmental and safety regulations. Proponents of the bullet train say it's greener than the status quo. Those opposed, skeptical of the cost, who will bear it, and how it'll affect landowners along the line. Well, Roundup is next. Stick around.
Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, whose research has helped bring more than 90 cancer-fighting drugs to the marketplace. Patients can access national clinical trials phases 1-4 in their communities. More at texasoncology.com.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. A 19-year-old is facing charges in connection with three small mercury spills in the Houston area Sunday. The FBI announced this morning Christopher Lee Melder was arrested and charged with burglary, unlawful disposal of hazardous material, and an outstanding felony drug possession warrant. City officials say less than a pint of the toxic metal was spilled in the parking lots of a Walmart, Sonic, and Shell gas station. Amid a nationwide outbreak of lung injuries linked to e-cigarette use, the largest school district in Texas is rolling out a new public health campaign. Houston Public Media's Sasha Cordner reports on Houston ISD's first ever Vaping Prevention Week.
The week starts today with HISD campus staff sharing an anti-vaping PSA with middle and high school students to start conversations about vaping prevention and awareness. Teacher LaShonda Roberts is included in the PSA video.
We're trying to stay in the front of it and prevent it from coming on our campuses and affecting our students.
Vaping Prevention Week also features several student activities, from investigating the chemicals found in e-cigarettes to interviewing an adult about vaping and creating their own warning labels for e-cigarettes. Of Texas's more than 200 cases of vaping linked to severe lung disease, a quarter are minors. Almost all were hospitalized. I'm Sasha Cordner in Houston.
Investigators are looking into what caused this weekend's fire at the new Texas Rangers ballpark, which has been under construction. KERA's Eric Austin reports.
The fire sent black smoke billowing through the stadium's retractable roof Saturday afternoon. The Arlington Fire Department says the fire was located and contained in the upper sections of Globe Life Field. It took about 30 minutes to extinguish. Construction officials say a crate of material staged in the roof area caught fire. No injuries were reported. It was unclear if the fire will cause construction delays in the $1.2 billion stadium. The Rangers are scheduled to play an exhibition game there March 23rd. The first regular season home game is March 31st. I'm Eric Austin in Dallas.
A Republican congressman from Texas who's often criticized President Trump plans to vote against impeachment. U.S. Representative Will Hurd of Helotes told CNN Sunday the process of impeachment is one of the most serious actions the House can take.
And even Speaker Pelosi said it should be bipartisan. The only thing bipartisan about this process is the opposition of impeachment. We're going to have at least two Democrats voting against this.
The House is expected to vote on articles of impeachment as early as Wednesday. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. It is an ant discovered in Texas that rides around on the back of other ants. If you were in the business of naming ants, what might you call that new ant? Exactly, a rodeo ant. But wait, it's not just one species of rodeo ant, but two that have been newly discovered by Alex Wild, curator of entomology and lecturer in the Department of Integrative Biology at the University of Texas at Austin, working with fellow researcher Jennifer Schlauch. Welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you very much.
And congratulations on the discovery.
You know, you're never bored when you're into insects.
No, I don't guess you are. So talk about only in Texas. Are these two ant species particularly lazy or especially clever?
I don't want to speculate on ant psychology, but they are.
What are they doing on the backs of other ants is what I'm asking.
Well, so, you know, most ants live their lives in these big colonies where there's a queen who lays all the eggs and there's all these worker ants running around digging the nest, taking care of the babies, getting the food, defending the nest. And that's all very costly. Mm-hmm. So there are a number of ant species that have figured out how to get other ant colonies to do all the work for them.
Wow.
And so these are called social parasites. Mm-hmm. We might have some in our own species, but I'm going to leave that aside.
You spared me from making a bad joke, Professor.
I made it myself. But anyway, so we have some social parasites who forego making their own workers that sneak into other ant nests and just sort of drop their own eggs into the brood pile.
Wow.
And persist that way. Taking advantage of the labor of other species. What's kind of cool about these new ones, though, is these parasitic ants ride on the bodies, on the backs of the queen ants of the colonies that they live in. And I don't know why they do this. We don't know much about these, but they are probably camouflaging themselves. Like guard ants aren't going to attack their own queens.
Sure.
So hanging out on a queen ant is a very safe place to be.
Interesting.
And plus, the host queen's going to be near the egg pile. So we think they're just hanging out on these queens, holding on super tight and dropping eggs into the brood pile.
I never saw these ants in my ant farm way back when. So I'm wondering how you found them.
This was one of those complete accidents of a discovery. I was just out taking a walk, went out, as I often do, just looking for bugs, and I flipped a stone, and I saw an ant colony underneath. There's nothing unusual about that, but I saw the queen ant running around. I'm like, oh, that's exciting. I don't see queens quite as often as I see there. And then I looked really close at her, and she had something golden on her back. And my first thought was, oh, this is probably like a parasitic beetle or something. So I quickly put it in a vial and took it back to the lab and looked under the microscope. And sure enough, it was another insect, but it wasn't a beetle. It was a little miniature queen ant. And I thought, huh, this must be one of those social parasites. There are some that are known from other groups of ants. And it reminded me in particular of a discovery that had been made in Florida about 15 years ago of a very similar ant in the same genus.
But you compared them and
I compared them totally different.
Wow.
It's the same genus, but in fact, structurally quite different.
But you found another ant that does the same thing?
So we immediately started looking for more, and there's all these great students who work out at Brackenridge Field Lab, and some of them started going out flipping stones and looking for ant colonies, and sure enough, another one turned up.
Wow.
And I thought, wow, we finally got a second one. Got it under the scope. Huh, this one's hairier than the other one.
That's fascinating.
It turned out to be a second species, and so The first one I found was on a relatively hairless, big-headed ant. And the social parasite, the rodeo ant queen, is relatively hairless. And the second one was hairier, and it lives on a hairier species of big-headed ant. So it looks like these rodeo ants are also mimicking some of the structures and textures of their hosts.
It does sound also like there may be a little bit of camouflage, evolutionary camouflage.
I suspect that's the case, and I really wish we could find more of these things, but they're pretty rare.
How rare is it that someone finds a new species of ant?
Well, a new species of ant is not that rare. We've got probably about 15,000 species of ants that are described. Those are the ones that have the formal Latin genus and species name. And there are dozens to hundreds of new names that come out every year. And we estimate that there's probably between 20 and 30,000 species of ants total. So we've probably done over half. Mm-hmm. Well, the thing is, there's 10 million species of insects out there, we think, and most of them aren't named. And, you know, there are new species all around us. I mean, it's a great field for discovery.
Alex Wild is curator of entomology and lecturer in the Department of Integrative Biology at the University of Texas at Austin. He's been working with researcher Jennifer Schlauch, as both have discovered different species of these rodeo ants here in Texas. Great to meet you. Thank you so much for stopping by our studios.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, dedicated to improving healthcare in North Texas and around the world through pursuits like the new TCU and UNTHSC School of Medicine, educating empathetic scholars. TCU, lead on. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Health officials and aid workers from the U.S. and Mexico want to find out how many asylum seekers at the border may be living with HIV. A delegation recently toured a migrant resource center and shelter in Matamoros, Mexico, and Texas Public Radio's Ronaldo Leaños Jr. was there.
The delegation's first stop was to a migrant resource center run by Gabby Zavala. The center offers legal services and some medical screenings. She told the health officials that she could open their space to help provide rapid HIV testing. Zavala says there's a need for testing here because many asylum seekers are afraid to leave the area. The resource center is right next to a tent encampment of more than 1,500 migrants. They've been waiting for months for their day in immigration court under the Trump administration's Remain in Mexico policy.
The fact that, you know, a tent city has emerged, you're talking about like a city within a city. The only difference is that all those things go unchecked. And so things like sexual assault, you know, rapes, and things like even just commercial sex work, you know, they go unchecked. And so being able to provide those services also gets people in treatment.
Zavala says it has taken months for health issues like HIV testing to become a priority.
We were first worried about what are they going to eat? Where are they going to stay? Now we get to start thinking about things like, well, what about health? You know, counseling, like STDs, HIV, things that often take the back burner because you're so worried about survival.
Before health officials left, they committed to following up in a few days to see how many rapid HIV testing kits they can provide. The next stop for the delegation was Casa Bougainvillea, a shelter where dozens of migrants are staying. The health officials gathered around a table to discuss how they can work together to provide information about resources for people who have HIV or may have the virus. Pedro Coronado is vice president of Access and Continuity of Care at Valley AIDS Council. He put together the delegation and tour. He says about a year ago, he received an email from someone saying there was a migrant Venezuelan father and son who were at Casa Bougainvillea and were HIV positive. From there, Coronado connected the family to health services so they could get treatment. That's Maria Esther Garza Garcia. She works at Casa Bougainvillea. She says she doesn't recall the father and son at their shelter having HIV. But Coronado says the Venezuelan family probably didn't say anything because they weren't comfortable talking about it, and says it's important to work together to provide information to the migrants. Dr. Carlos Alberto Carrillo Garza was also on the tour today. He's the director of CAPACITS, a Mexican government organization that helps people with STDs and HIV. He says he's happy aid workers from both countries were on the tour because they've already built trust with the migrants.
Es más fácil que ellos acepten la prueba rápida a través de ellos a que la acepten.
He says it's much easier for migrants to accept the rapid HIV testing from them rather than someone with the Mexican government health department. He also says if someone is diagnosed with HIV, there's a process asylum seekers can go through to get treatment in Mexico. The tour was part of a bigger effort by U.S. and Mexican health officials to come up with a plan to address HIV in communities on both sides of the border. Pedro Coronado with Valley AIDS Council says now that they've met with organizations, the next step is drafting and enacting a plan so they can begin testing more people and get them into treatment. I'm Reynaldo Leaños Jr. in Matamoros.
Texas has no shortage of festivals, some about food, some about music, some about, just celebrating what's unique about one small town or another. But a new one planned for next April promises to be something a little different, and since it's the first time it's happening, right now it's a little hard to define. To help us get a grasp of it, however, we asked David Coleman to stop by. He's the director of the Whitliff Collections and is helping to organize what is the first ever Whitliff Collections Festival. David, thanks for stopping by the Texas Standard Studios.
My pleasure.
I see a lot of announcements come over the transom about a new festival of one type or another, and this one caught a lot of people's attention here at the Standard, in part because the Whitliff Collections have become such a real treasure here in Texas. I suppose we need to back up for a moment before we talk about the festival.
Sure.
And talk about the collections. Bill Whitliff, the man who passed away.
Yes,
This past June. Is that what sort of sparked the idea to focus on the Whitliff Collection here?
Well, we've done fundraisers in the past. We are kind of a unique collection down at Texas State, and we want to create a cultural repository for the creative culture of Texas and the Southwest, founded by Bill and Sally in 1986. So we've been at it for a while, amassed remarkable collections of literary, photography, and now Texas music.
Tell us a little bit about Bill Whitliff and why he was so interested in collecting this stuff.
He was an amazing, amazing person and kind of a creative godfather in Austin in many different ways. And he was from small town Texas and really felt the power of storytelling at a young age. And when he recognized that stories that he was hearing being told him on front porches, et cetera, were actually written down, this was a monumental awakening for him as a young man. He and his wife, Sally, found a press called Encino Press dedicated to publishing Texas stories, basically. Mm-hmm. The first story out of the gate is a book given to them by J. Frank Dobie. Of course, one of the godfathers of Texas letters.
Yeah.
He got a call in the kind of the mid-80s from Mr. Dobie's former secretary about wanting to maybe buy Mr. Dobie's desk. So Bill went over to the house and saw the desk, but also saw some other materials that were just sitting in boxes and asked, well, what's going to happen with those? And they acquired some Dobie diaries, correspondence, some teaching notes from when he taught in England, some just remarkable Dobie materials.
And so a magnificent collection began to grow out of that, sort of snowball.
That's right.
And so now we have a festival which will be celebrating some of these folks of letters, the creative types that Whitliff wanted to celebrate with this collection. So what exactly do you anticipate happening at this festival in April?
It's kind of a full day of programming. We have four panel discussions capped off by a gala fundraiser in the evening with live performance by Robert Earl Keen and Ray Benson.
Nice.
So it's a real celebration of commentary and creative culture about our place on Earth.
Could this become an annual thing?
I think annual will be a goal we'll try to reach for. I think right now we're talking about every other year, looking to see how to make it more generally accessible to the public, broader panels. But we really want to always focus. And I think that is what is going to that will make us special, is that we focus on Texas artists focusing on Texas, even if they're not from Texas, but all about, you know, this part of the world.
sounds like our kind of festival, I must say.
Yeah. Well, we've been going strong for over 30 years. We think we have a really special place that we love to share with people. And bringing it to Austin seems like the really smart thing to do.
It's going to be April 18th, right? Yes. Here in the Texas capital city, the first ever Whitliffe Collections Festival. David Coleman is the director of the Whitliffe Collections, housed at Texas State University in San Marcos. Mr. Coleman, thanks so much for stopping by the Texas Standard Studios. Look forward to the festival.
You bet.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Tuition Promise Fund. For over 10 years, helping families lock in current tuition rates and required fees at Texas public colleges and universities, excluding medical and dental institutions. TexasTuitionPromiseFund.com. Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with small and mid-sized companies by helping to unify their businesses and achieve digital transformation. More at RandGroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Researchers have found strong support for the idea that a police department should look like the city it serves. But many departments in Texas don't. Most are a lot more male and a lot more white than the general population. KERA's Christopher Connolly says it's an issue Fort Worth has been grappling with in recent years after a string of controversial policing incidents involving people of color.
No justice! No peace! No justice!
At a vigil one day after a Tatiana Jefferson was killed by a white police officer, community advocates raged. They said Fort Worth black residents don't feel safe with the city's predominantly white police department. Deborah Peoples leads the Tarrant County Democratic Party.
When officers come in our communities, they come in combat mode. We don't have a chance.
Yes!
This is not a training issue with the Fort Worth Police Department. This is a cultural issue.
Since the October shooting, there have been calls to hire more officers of color. The city is only 40% white, but nearly two-thirds of Fort Worth police officers are white. Corey Sessions sat on the city's task force on race and culture, which looked at the issue.
If you don't have a police force that is representative or looks like your city, you run into issues, culture issues, biases.
Sessions says he often sees bias and stereotypes and a general lack of understanding overshadow police interactions.
We all have prejudices. We all have these preconceived ideas. But as an officer, and these are life and death situations that can turn on an instant, you got to be careful.
Over the last decade, the police force has grown more diverse, from nearly 70% white in 2010 to 65% now. But blacks, Latinos, and Asians are still significantly underrepresented, and less than 13% of Fort Worth police are women. Nelson Lim says numbers like these are unsurprising.
It is extremely common. I mean, unfortunately, it is extremely common across the whole country.
Lim studies recruitment at the RAND Corporation and has worked with police departments to increase officer diversity.
It's not necessarily that it's all about racism, you know, discrimination, but it's more subtle, it's more nuanced.
There are two common barriers, Lim says. The first, propensity. Who actually wants to become a police officer? Many young people of color are reluctant to pursue a policing career, he says, and may hold police officers in less esteem.
So if the minority youth and minority populations has lower propensity to serve as a police officer, then you already start behind.
For those who do apply, Lim says the vetting process can disproportionately sideline people of color and women. Entry tests may be written in a way that offers white people an advantage. More women fail physical tests than men. And background checks can disadvantage people who grow up in communities that are more heavily policed. Assistant City Manager Jay Chapa oversees the 1,600-member Fort Worth Police Department.
We're trying to make changes to improve the situation when it comes to having the police department reflect the community.
The city's reviewing its vetting process to eliminate bias. On top of that, it's targeting police recruitment efforts to reach more people of color. There's a volunteer boot camp to help women train for the physical test. And the city's reinstating a paid police cadet program to introduce high school and community college students to law enforcement careers. But Chapa says a strong economy means some well-qualified candidates aren't applying to be cops because there's better pay and easier work outside of policing. And Fort Worth's not alone in focusing on diversity.
Minority and women candidates are at a premium, and every city's after them. So there's competition when it comes to that.
Still, improving officer diversity isn't a panacea. It can help build trust, research shows, but policing experts say cities should also focus on the culture within police departments and build stronger relationships with marginalized communities. I'm Christopher Connolly in Fort Worth.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Social media editor Wells Dunbar joins us once again in the studio to share with us what Texans are talking about, and what would that be on this Monday?
Well, let's see, David, where to start. Let's start with the runoff election in Houston. You follow any of that this weekend?
Interesting. Yeah, I watched stuff. A little bit of it. I think the mayor won re-election.
He indeed, yes. Incumbent Mayor Sylvester Turner beat back a challenge from wealthy trial lawyer Tony Busby. Interesting here after the fact, Busby didn't exactly concede the race. Instead, the flamboyant figure posted a picture to Instagram of him aboard his private plane looking ready for a vacation, including the caption, "We need a bit of R&R and then we will be back with a vengeance. Thank you for all the support. We love you, Houston." Lots of folks chiming in about this on our Facebook page. Rachel K.G. Miller says Busby spent $12 million of his own money on that campaign, saying you can add him to the growing list of self-funded one percenters who lose handily in elections. I think referring there to the sort of late interest we've seen among the Democratic presidential field with all these self-funded candidates. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Keith Harris, however, calls the news disturbing. He says, "I pray that his attitude," referring here to Sylvester Turner, I should say, says, "I pray that Sylvester Turner's attitude would change for the Houston firefighters," referring there to issues the mayor's had with that constituency over pay raises for firefighters that came to a boil with a proposition in a previous election that mandated these pay raises, and then City Hall responded by announcing layoffs. Then that plan was canceled. Mm-hmm. So no love lost there, a little bit of a mess. Houston politics not going anywhere.
Nope.
Well, speaking of messes, Governor Greg Abbott finding himself in a bit of one after responding to a random tweet about a Dr. Pepper shortage at a local Whataburger.
There's a Dr. Pepper shortage?
Well, apparently there was. I forget where exactly, but you know, the governor, he's active on Twitter, and someone jokingly tagged him on a tweet saying, "My Whataburger is out of Dr. Pepper. What can we do, Governor?" To which the governor responded, "Get a rope." Yes, it's a reference to the old Pace Picante sauce commercial, yeah. But one with here in Texas with its sordid history of lynching coming more into the light is seen as insensitive by many. So people picking up on that. No, I don't think we've seen any sort of response from the governor yet. But this on his personal Twitter feed where he does, you know, riff more, I guess you could say, mm-hmm. Than his official account there. One that's generating a fair amount of attention there.
I will imagine. I would imagine so.
Yes, sir. You know what else is going to be the big talk of news watchers everywhere later this week? The House expected to vote Wednesday on whether to impeach President Trump. Folks chiming in about this new, nearly 650-page plus report from the Judiciary Committee. People chiming in, sharing their thoughts with us. Janice Hitchcock says that a vast majority of Americans have not been watching the hearings, so she's concerned about what that may mean for this impeachment proceeding as it goes forward. Notes that he and his personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani, still actively committing the crime for which he's being impeached, referring there to Giuliani's trips abroad to the Ukraine looking for dirt, I guess you could say, on the Bidens. Meanwhile, David Ortiz says the only ones to fault here are the Democrats and the ones that support them, so obviously that polar continuing to pull you out there on the old impeachment front.
We were talking about that NPR survey, which sort of seems to confirm that very thing. We're out of time for the big broadcast, but we would love to hear from you if we have not yet. You know what to do. Just get on social media and look for Texas Standard and shoot us your thoughts about what's making news in your part of Texas. Who knows? I mean, it might be a story we haven't yet heard about, and we would love to follow up. We're going to be here tomorrow, and we hope you will join us. Till then, I'm David Brown, along with Wells Dunbar, wishing you a marvelous Monday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Woldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington family.